Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. I am Josh Spicer, and we got a great cast for you tonight. First, please welcome to the cast my contributor and growing helper here on Game Wisdom, who will slowly rise up from the ranks of intern, James Ellerby.
There can be only one.
James, how's everything going? I know you're around my area. I know we're both trying to beat the heat right now.
Yeah, beating the heat. Feeling a little bit older. Tomorrow is my birthday, so gonna be turning a little bit older and realizing the growing pains of mortality.
Yeah. Well, I know for those of you listening, it'll probably be too late, but James, definitely pre-happy birthday then for me.
Well, thank you.
And for tonight's cast, we have a new guest on. He is the creative lead from the studio Ninja 5, who are currently working on the game Baluk: Mayan Warfare. Please welcome to the podcast, Trayvon Taylor.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, Trayvon. It's great to meet you and have you on the cast today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So, for those of you listening to the cast, I actually met Trayvon through Twitter. For those of you who've been keeping notice of the Twitter and the social media side, I've been getting a little bit more involved there, trying to grow out the site, especially try to grow out the YouTube channel, and it definitely seems to be working. And Trayvon, thanks so much for responding to my Twitter response, and I think we're going to have a great cast tonight.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for reaching out to me.
Awesome. So, to get things going, since this is your first time on the cast, Trayvon, could you tell everyone a little bit about yourself and your studio?
Okay, a little bit about myself. So, I was born and raised in... can you guys hear me clearly?
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, I was born and raised in Antioch, California. Always had a passion for art. I realized I wanted to go to an art school. It was like around 10th grade when the Academy of Art Expressions in the Art Institute, they sent people down to our school to talk about their different programs. And that's when I found out that people actually get paid, like they can go to school and get paid to make games. So that's when I made that decision. So then senior year of high school, I took a 3D animation class, and that's when I like just fell in love with the 3D aspect. Like that's when I knew for surely I wanted to do 3D modeling for games. So I ended up going to the Art Institute in Sacramento for the game art and design program. I specialized in environment and prop art. During my time there, I was the president of our school's game development club. We didn't get that much done, but it taught me a lot about like managing a team, what motivates people. Like you really got to find what motivates people when they come home from school, they work on their projects and stuff, right? A new game just came out. So then they got to make that decision. Are they going to work on this side project or are they going to play a new video game? So stuff like that. So then I ended up graduating in 2014, December. Mm-hmm. I was a contractor with Apple for a few months, working on their 3D maps. Ever since then, I've just been working on Baluk full time.
Okay. Now,
that's pretty much summarized about me.
All right. Now, your actual studio, Ninja... Oh, I'm sorry. One second. And your actual studio, Ninja 5, did you guys sort of meet at the Art Institute, or did you sort of form after you graduated?
It formed after we graduated. Like, this is how it formed, actually. It was really funny. While I was working at Apple, I realized that I wanted to get started on this game very, very soon. Because, like, at the time, I was 22 years old. This was actually back in, like, October when I made that decision that I was going to, like, build it now. Because originally, the plan was work in the industry for 10 years and then start my own studio. But I was like, wait a minute, now's the perfect chance. So when I would get off work at home, I would go home, work on the project and stuff, right? And one of my coworkers, her name was Steph Goringer. She was telling me about the project she did back in school and how her boyfriend, he's a game designer too, and he can program. And I was like, well, I need a programmer. And I asked her, would he be interested in programming? And she said, well, I would need to show something for the game. Yeah. So I knew the best way to attract people to your project is to have something already there. That way people will want to get onto the project. That would increase your chances of getting quality people.
Yeah.
So I just started planning out the environment. I actually built up the environment. I built up one of our first levels. It's called the Siege of Tikal. It's like a very massive level, actually. I built that out in Unity. I showed her. I had her show her boyfriend. His name is Samuel Ryder. He liked the environment, so he wanted to team up with me. So that's how I got my programmer. So then I was like, I need an animator. Like, at the time, I didn't need any animations at the time, but I knew I was going to need an animator soon. So I hit up one of my buddies. His name is Radifle Alexander. We went to high school with each other, and he was in my 3D animation class as well. So we both graduated back in 2011. He ended up going to the Art Institute in San Francisco. So I said, hey, man, I'm working on this game right now, man. Would you, like, want to help me out with it? I need animations done. And he agreed to it. So then I'm an environment artist, but my drawing skills aren't on that professional level. So I was like, I need someone to do cover art for me, promotional art for me. So I hit up my friend Calvin. Calvin, actually, he did a Mayan-themed concept art for me back in college. Mm-hmm. I met him at the Art Institute. He graduated a year before me. So he started working on our cover art, actually. Like that new cover art that you see in the press kit, mm-hmm. that was him. He's like, he's very awesome.
Yeah.
So then, who else did we recruit next? Because it was weird. I kind of felt like, have you seen the new X-Men movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of felt like Apocalypse going around recruiting people and stuff to the cause. That's exactly, or like I'm Nick Fury or something. I kid you not. So then, I'm trying to think, who did I approach next? Okay, so Samuel, he was programmed, like he was creating the gameplay and stuff, but we were just using placeholder assets. So I was like, oh man, we need our character model now. Mm-hmm. So Calvin had finished up our cover art, which we kind of used as our concept art too. So after talking to a few people, I finally found a character modeler. His name is Theron Green. I also went to school with him at the Art Institute. So I was talking to him, and then he actually liked the stuff I was posting because I was already posting to social media mm-hmm. about the stuff I was already doing with Bullock. So that right there, that also helped me convince people to join me because they already seen the stuff I was already putting out.
Yeah.
So Theron, he already liked how the game was looking. So he wanted to create character models for me. So he began working on our character model. So then I realized we need another animator because I knew environment art, prop art, lighting, texturing. I can work with the game engine,
mm-hmm.
but I built my team around the skills that I did not have.
Yeah.
So I was like, we need another animator. So I was talking to my friend Jeff Woodward. I also went to school with him at the Art Institute. And he liked the work that was coming out from Bullock. And he wanted to work on the project as well. So I said, hey, man, well, welcome to the team. So he started creating our animations for us. And then, oh, also Steph, my coworker back from Apple. So, yeah, she wanted to work on the project as well since her boyfriend was working on it as well. So I was like, yeah, why not? You know, I liked working with Steph at mm-hmm. Apple. She actually taught me, like, when I started working there. She was the one that trained me on how to use the software and stuff. So I seen the work that she's done, and I know she has a good work ethic. So I said, yeah, like it would be cool to have you on the team. So she does our UI right now, and she's also doing some other 3D models that I don't do.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, though, she's doing the UI.
Yeah.
That's pretty much how I assembled the team.
Awesome. And a lot of really good points there you made, Trayvon, about the creation of the team and working in a group or a studio format. It's one of the things that we see from a lot of indie developers, especially first-time developers, they can tend to mess up on. I really like how you said a few minutes ago that you want to try to balance the creative with the business side. And as a great like serendipity moment, that's pretty much the post I just made in terms of when we're recording, I just put up today about what it means to be an independent developer and the fact that you need to balance being artistic with running a business or managing a group. And I like how you said that you approach people who had different skill sets than yourself, the people who can help you out the most with making this game. There's always that push and pull, especially with game development, between do you try and do a little bit of everything yourself? Do you try to reach out to people who can assist you or who have skills beyond your own knowledge base? And we typically see, especially with successful games, that you do need people who can not only just complement your skills, but who can also do things that you can't. And it sounds like you made a lot of really exactly. smart plans, especially this is your first game, right? But look, this is like your actual first title as a game developer, right?
You can say that. I built a game in college. Mm-hmm. It was called 10 Minute Takedown.
Okay.
I was the prop artist. There was like 20 of us. It was for our game prototyping yeah. class. It was about 6 months long.
Okay. Yeah, so it definitely seems like you are already ahead of the curve, especially with a lot of students, a lot of people getting out of college trying to make games. I know when I first try to do it, I try to like put together a random group of people, and the problem that I ran into was that, one, it felt like we didn't have specialized people. There wasn't the quote-unquote dedicated programmer. There wasn't the person who knew how to do art, etc. And when you have like so many people trying to do everything, it becomes very hard to manage that project. But definitely sounds like you're ahead of the curve with reaching out to these people and getting people that you know who can do these specific tasks.
Exactly. Like, this comes from experience. Because like I said before, I used to be president of our game development club. We didn't get shit done. I ate a lot of shit back then. Like, this all comes from, like, experience, man. Like, if this was my first go-around, like, at, like, trying to, like, build a team and stuff, yeah, I probably would have failed miserably. But because I know, like, how not to build a team from my previous experiences, like, that's why it made it a lot easier.
Yeah, definitely. I've tried my hand at trying to put, like, local groups together in the past, and they have both failed. And you learn from these experiences. And it's just very important, especially for someone entering the game industry now, to really start with as many advantages as they can get. Because one thing that I've been speaking to some veteran game developers about, that while today is one of the best times to get into the industry, it's also one of the hardest times to make your own mark, because everyone is literally trying to make their own game and be their own studio.
Yeah, yeah.
I hear you. Yeah, it does seem that, like, especially, like, okay, so everybody, like, there's a lot of people learning how to do game development, whether they're trying to work at a studio or actually trying to make their games, and you are right. All you gotta do is look at Steam Greenlight in Early Access. You see, there's all kinds of games there. And there's a lot of games there that should not be there. Like, no disrespect to the hardworking developers, but there's a lot of games on there that should not be there. Yeah. But people are doing it anyways, and that kind of shows you that, it's becoming more what's that word called? Like a democracy almost, where, like, everybody has
a demographic. Demographic?
I can't pronounce it.
I know the word you're thinking of, and I can't pronounce it either.
Bro, blame the internet. The internet, it gave everybody an opportunity, but at the same time, though, it kind of, like, a lot of people in that shouldn't have been. But the cool thing is, though, if you're good at what you're doing, you're going to shine no matter what. Yeah. That's the crazy thing about it.
Very true.
Definitely. And we are seeing a lot of those cases very lately. I mean, Stardew Valley came from a guy who worked on a game for 2 years by himself, and it was a passion project, and it worked. And we're seeing, as you just said, Trey, on that, the people who can make a quality title and who understand the business side are the ones who are ultimately going to succeed the most.
Yeah, it's going to weed itself out, but you do need that. I honestly believe it's a really beautiful thing where you have this forest of just possibility. And with possibility comes success, but it also comes failure. And you are going to need those guys. And I think there's going to be a lot of these cases where you look back and go, that one crappy game that was on Steam, the people that did that crappy game are now working on one of the most successful games out there. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to see a lot of those success stories, I think, in a couple of years. Where, like, you can go back and play, you know, the dungeon walkthrough RPG basic number 55, and then the people that
work like
that end up being big names in the, I was trying to make the most, like, like the most stereotypical game you find on there, but, paddle ball.
Roguelike or survival.
And I think part of the difficulty of that, and I know I agree with you, James, that you definitely need to fail, I think, to learn the most. I mean, I've certainly failed at a lot of things myself, but one, the risk with game development is that for a lot of studios, there's always that temptation to put everything on the line with your one idea. And this is something that I talk with Z from Serenity Forge about. That passion can be great, but it can also be blinding in some cases. And this is where the enthusiasm versus understanding the business really comes in handy. When you know the business side of things, you know not to, you know, put all your money on an idea that's completely unproven, and you can mitigate some of those risks. And when you can do that, then you can have a failure and say, okay, this didn't work, but now let's make something great out of that. Let's take that idea and take everything that we learned that we did wrong and do it right this time.
Or it might even inspire somebody else who, like, you'd be surprised how many people, like, love some of the crappiest games out there. I mean, look at the early PlayStation era. Like, the early PlayStation era, like, PlayStation, like, the first PlayStation had so many bad games in it that, like, inspired so much greatness later on. You know what I mean? A lot of people took finer points from these horrible games. I was looking at a game. I was watching Maximilian Dude play a game called Biofreaks. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Oh my god, it is an literally.
I've heard of it.
You haven't heard of it? Josh, you definitely gotta watch.
No, I have not heard of it.
Oh, you never heard of it? Okay, you guys gotta watch Maximilian Dude play Biofreaks. He tries to beat the hardest boss, and it's one of those games where you could tell it was trying to do a 3D version of Mortal Kombat, and it was just like, and not just crappy textures for the day that for the age that it was made in, but you could just tell it was a horrible collision, horrible texturing, like everything was just bad about this game. But it's one of those hidden gems that if you got it because everybody was making games back when the PlayStation came out because the hardware was so easy. If you got it, you know, you could tell there's a lot of games nowadays that have little things in it that really that you could tell that guy probably played Biofreaks and stuff like that. So,
and I think another good part of that is how much the game industry has really standardized its methodology and its philosophy in a lot of areas over the last decade. We've seen this with control design. We've seen this with how developers are approaching the use of achievements, metagame progression. We mentioned a few minutes ago, jokingly, the roguelike genre. But the roguelike genre has really become a foundation for a lot of very interesting games. Stuff like Darkest Dungeon, Duskers, Invisible Ink, etc., etc.
Enter the Gungeon.
And again, as we said at the start of this cast, this is definitely a really great time to be a game developer, especially with the level of transparency that's happening. And I think a perfect example of that is me being able to talk to you, Trayvon. Like, these kinds of conversations would never have happened 10, 15 years ago. One, the technology wouldn't be available, and two, it just really wasn't the time for an independent developer. But today, there's so much resources out there, and I think we're really going to see a lot more from the independent market, or I should say we've already seen a lot more over the last 5 years.
Yeah, like, that's what I like about this internet. Like, like I said, it's resources. Like, it's increased the amount of resources. It's opened the floodgates for people to try their hand at this. Like, yeah, there's a lot of garbage coming out. But at the same time, though, you have those people who are really good and this kind, and they just changed their life. Mm-hmm. And that's why I made a decision. I'm like, dude, this is the perfect time to make the game. I've had the failures in the past. Like, I know what not to do. And I'm taking the concept of a hack and slash game mixed with a strategy title. Like, I know it's gonna work. I'm not testing some unknown concept.
Yeah.
Because you see, there's like different types of games. Like one was like, oh, this is very innovative and stuff. This is a new concept. Like, yeah, I'm taking something new, such as introducing the Mayan cultures, but I'm using something that I know that works. The hack and slash genre, the strategy genre, and I'm throwing my own mix on it. So earlier when you're talking about what was that? You were talking about how games are like being innovative now, coming out with new ideas and stuff, like risky stuff. Like, yeah, you got to like walk that line of risky versus you know it's going to work versus it being innovative. Yeah,
exactly.
You got to know where to change things up and when not to change the wheel, when not to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, that is a perfect statement there, Traylon. And that's another really good lesson that a lot of developers, especially a lot of first-time developers, struggle with learning. When I spoke with Ernest Adams earlier in 2014, we came up with the idea of that great game design harmonizes. It's something where everything works. And too often, when first-time developers go for, as you just said, you know, reinventing the wheel, they make something that, yes, it's unique, but it doesn't, like, work right. Maybe they have some kind of crazy control scheme. Maybe the game just literally doesn't make sense. Or it's some, like, crazy combination of mechanics and genres that, again, it's untested and no one's ever done it before, but maybe there is a reason why no one ever did it this way.
Goat Simulator.
That is funny.
Yeah. Thank you, James. Goat Simulator.
Goat Simulator.
But it's these kinds of conversations, again, what you just said, John, with knowing these two genres, the hack and slash and the strategy. You looked at them, you figure out, you know, what makes them work, how to combine them, and you took that and made that your core foundation. And we'll talk more in depth about Bullock probably in the next few minutes. But that is a really good point to make about being able to analyze these genres and mechanics and figure out what makes them work. And that's another really key trait of a successful game developer, that level of analytical examination.
Right. That makes perfect sense. It's like we were saying, like knowing when to change things up versus when not to reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. Like people like, yeah, they come up with these crazy concepts and it's not grounded in like something's already been tested out, you know?
And
like, I'll give you a prime example. I can't think of one off the top of my head right now. As a matter of fact, my bad.
But yeah, and like when you do decide to make something unique or never before seen or untested, it's still important to do the legwork and don't commit to something until you've had a chance to test it out. When I spoke with Chris Park from Arkane Games, they make some very high concept strategy games. We're talking systems on top of systems, you know, the 4X genre. He always said that the best thing to do is to start small, start with your core system, and see if that works. You don't want to, you know, bet the farm on, you know, 20 different ideas if you don't even know how your basic mechanics are going to work.
Sure.
And
exactly.
When it works, then you can say, okay, now let's build this out. And if it doesn't work, you can say, okay, let's try something else. At least we didn't spend, you know, 2 years working on this idea, and now we know it doesn't work.
The worst is when you quit your job. The worst is when you quit your full-time job to try something that's untested, and then it doesn't work. That's like the worst.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So I think with that said, we had a good introduction to you and to your studio. Let's talk a little bit more about Bullock itself and sort of the concept and mechanics of that. So we've talked a little bit, bits and pieces, about what the game is. But for this section, for people listening, Traylon, could you, I guess, give us sort of like, what is Bullock, like the pitch of it?
The pitch of it. You basically play as a Mayan warlord who wants to unite the rest of the Maya. So on one hand, it plays out on like a 3D tabletop where like you're managing your empire, you're micromanaging stuff. But then when it comes down to the actual battles, you're actually going out there in the battlefield as a hack and slash, like a god of war. Like you're just out there, like instead of it being like turn-based or like an RTS thing, like in Total War, you're actually out there doing the damage and conquering the cities.
Interesting. Now you said that you...
But summarize it though.
I'm sorry?
What'd you say?
Oh, I was just... I think we may be talking over each other. What I was saying was, it sounds very interesting. Now, you said at the start of this cast that this was an idea that you first started conceiving back when you were in college. Is that right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, like, the idea actually hit me back in... Do you want to know the story of, like, how I got the idea?
Can you give us, like, the short version or just, like, the quick pitch of it?
Okay, so I had this writing class called Conceptual Storytelling back in college, and I was just looking at different paintings and stuff for an idea for a story. I knew I wanted to do something tribal, and I kept seeing like paintings of like Mayan temples, like scenery, like scenes from Apocalypto, and it fascinated me how the Mayan temples were actually painted and stuff. And I was like, that would be cool to do a story about the Mayans, and then that's when I came up with the idea. I was like, I gotta create a game about the Mayans. It would be cool to have something where it's a strategy game, but I can actually fight the battles using an actual character instead of doing some instead of it being solved on like an invisible dice roll or something.
And it's interesting that you just brought about that appreciation of Mayan architecture, because as I was saying before the cast, it reminds me a lot of what Crow Team and sort of their inspiration for games like Serious Sam and the Talos Principle, and how they really love like ancient civilization architecture. I know they were huge with Egyptian architecture and a lot of that classic design. And it's always funny when we talk to developers about their inspirations and their sources, as you never hear the same story twice. And I just love it, like when you hear like someone like looking at something, you get that aha moment, and you go, oh, I can turn this into a game. Now, with...
Yeah, that's pretty much what happened.
Now, with Bullock, as you just said, it's combining two genres. You have the one hand, you have the turn-based strategy or management side of things with the hack and slash or the on-the-field combat. And I think this goes back to what we were just saying a few minutes ago. Combining these two is definitely a unique idea, but you're combining them from a place that you know the strategy genre, you know the hack and slash genre, and you can sort of see how things are going to start to like fit into place. So my question for you, Trayvon.
Yeah, without it messing with each other.
Mm-hmm. So my question for you then regarding these like designs then, like how does someone like approach playing the game? Now obviously it's still being developed as we're speaking, so we can't talk about like specific stuff, but how do you see like a general play of Bullet going for someone?
You mean how does it play out? Yeah. I'm a little confused.
Yeah.
Oh, like, explain like oh, I think I get what you're saying. Okay, so like I said before, imagine you start off on like a 3D campaign map, mm-hmm. right? You have all your cities laid. You have your cities, the cities that you own, the enemy cities, like the enemy factions, mm-hmm. right? Laid out on this campaign map. Think of like a tabletop, mm-hmm. like a imagine a tabletop almost, but it's like 3D though.
Yeah,
we call it the campaign map.
Mm-hmm.
So you, like I said, you micromanage your city. You choose like, hey, should I build a wall here? Mm-hmm. Should I build a barrier? Okay, let's say you end your turn now. The enemy decides they want to attack you. They're moving their army along the tabletop. Mm-hmm. And they're about to attack you. They're about to attack your city. So usually, like, for instance, in Civilization, right, in the Civ series, when that happens, whoever has the better stats, it, like, plays out like an animation. Whoever has better stats wins. Or in the Total War series, you go into battle, and you control your army. You choose, you tell your troops where to go in order to during the battle. So instead of that happening, you basically get sent out to the field. Mm-hmm. Imagine like a side scroller, because it is a side scrolling hack and slash. It's 2.5D. So instead of it, so when the battle segment comes up, your character moves around like a side scroller.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah,
that's pretty much how it plays out.
All right, and it sounds like you're going with a lot of like the metagame, sort of like the campaign or the strategy side is inferring on the combat, like. I guess my next question then is,
mm-hmm.
how do these two systems, like, interact? Like, if I'm on the strategy side and I start fights, what does my decisions on the strategy side affect when it's time for combat? And then how do we reverse that? Like, after I'm done a fight, what is my outcome during this battle affect things back on the strategic map?
I'm glad you asked that question. Okay, perfect example. In the strategy layer, you research a spell, mm-hmm. like a flame spell, okay, that you didn't have before. You did the research on the strategy layer. It comes time for the actual battle. Guess what? Your warrior can start shooting out fire magic mm-hmm. now. So then you're on the battlefield. Instead of just relying on your mock wadle, that's the Aztec swords. Instead of just relying on your regular weapons, you can start using magic now, like spells that you unlocked from doing research. So instead of doing like the whole skill tree thing, it's actually research, mm-hmm. like you're researching technology. So then you conquer a city, right? So you win the battle. So you defeat the enemies in the environment. You conquer the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you have access to the resources. You start receiving gold now per turn. With this gold now, you start building better building structures. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can build a better research facility, like a better temple that gives you even better spells.
Okay. Now, during the actual combat itself, are you controlling, like, a main character? Are you controlling, like, a soldier in the field? Like, what's that level of abstraction?
So you control the warrior in the field. Right now we're going with the whole you control 4 customizable warriors.
Mm-hmm.
Like in XCOM, you know, like you had your soldiers that you can customize and stuff and you send them out into the field. Like that. So, but you use 4 for the battle. But you use 1 at a time, though. You just switch back and forth. Okay. When all 4 die, you lose the battle. So if someone's attacking your city
mm-hmm.
and all 4 of your warriors die, you just lost their city.
All right, so mm-hmm. the warriors are sort of like your extra lives during a combat situation, but you can still customize them in different ways.
That's exactly how it is, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Definitely sounds like a very interesting concept. And again, I'm liking that kind of like metagame progression. It does sound a lot like the Total War side of things, but it feels like there's definitely more interaction between the metagame or the strategy layer with the combat layer, with how you said, with like upgrading your characters, giving them new abilities, stuff like that.
Josh, have you ever played any of the Dynasty Warriors
series?
Yes,
definitely.
Have you ever played the offshoot of the Dynasty Warriors series, Dynasty Warriors Empires?
I've heard of them, but I have not.
Trayvon, have you ever played any of the Dynasty Warriors Empire series?
I played them a long time ago, and okay. The thing I didn't like about it, now I think about it, I remember playing it. It was all right, but the battles though it was something of, you're a one man army, but the combat didn't feel right to me at the time. Okay. I like the idea of customizing your character. You know, you're trying to conquer everyone else. This was during their the War and States era and stuff. Mm-hmm. I just didn't like the combat. So I'm thinking it would be cool if you had a strategy, you have everything you like about a strategy game with a game that has cool combat that you actually like. Mm-hmm. I like the Total War series as well, but it would be cool to actually be out there and actually cause the damage and stuff instead of being that general with a bird's eye view.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You want to be actually on the field leading the troops as opposed to watching them from a thought perspective. Yeah.
Now, that actually brings up a really
Exactly.
And James, you just brought up a really good point that I want to ask Trayvon about with the combat of Bullock. In terms of the actual mechanics itself, how involved do you see the combat system? I'll give you some examples. We see games where it's a simple one button, you're just hitting attack over and over again. And then we have on the far end of the spectrum, we can see games Fahrenheit or Dark Souls, where you have a really in-depth combat system, very skill-based built around it. So, I guess, where do you see the combat going in Bullock?
We're trying to go more for that Arkham City / Shadow of Mordor feel. Okay.
So it's a few buttons, but you're going to have a lot in terms of timing, a lot in terms of sort of controlling the battlefield. So the player doesn't need to know 5 or 6 different buttons, but there's a lot more context-sensitive actions they can use.
Yeah, not that many buttons, but a lot of combinations that can be done. Mm-hmm. The whole countering, ground executions, stunning your enemies, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because because you know what you're saying, there's basic combat, and then there's that hardcore Dark Souls. We're trying to go for the middle ground where it's Arkham City, Shadow of Mordor, where not that many buttons, but you combine these buttons, so you can get a lot done.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, I actually have a real big question, and it comes from my personal experience as a martial artist, and I've given a couple of lectures on martial arts, too, from around the world. How are you going to get the combat correct for the time frame? Are you looking at mocap actors to come in? Are you going to kind of look at different pictures and try to make the actions based on that? Because you are dealing with an entire culture of warriors who fought differently.
Yeah.
At their own, you can't make it, it's not going to be a kung fu flick, or it's not going to be believable, you know what I mean? But it's also not going to be, a samurai flick. These are their minds. Mm-hmm. And how I'm really interested, because as a martial artist, a longtime martial artist and teacher, I want to know how you're going to bring these warriors to life.
So as of right now, the combat, we want it to be over the top. So this is it's brutal, humorous, there's humor to it, it's over the top, right? So when I think of brutal over the top combat, we think about 300. Do you remember the first battle in 300?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
How over the top that was?
Okay.
Would you say?
Yes.
Yeah, we look at images, we look at footage from for our references and stuff. But it would be cool, later on down the line to actually get mocap people in to make it more authentic. But for right now though, we're just using video reference, like I said, 300, the over the top action. But at the end of the day though, we do want to give it that authentic, Mayan feel.
And honestly,
so, in the future, like I said before,
Something that could really help you and your team out. Something that could really help you and your team out, just do a search on Mayan warfare combatants, historical combatants, anybody that would be knowledgeable in that area, and do this. Get them on Skype. Have them talk to you about what kind of warfare, what kind of weapons, what the name of the weapons were, how those weapons were used, and see about, and trust me, the people that play the game are going to love that little extra mile that you add to it. It's the little things that really help separate that game that everybody's heard of to that game that really took the time to give, not just have all the fun stuff and the awesome kick-ass moves, but also was teaching people a little bit about Mayan warfare and Mayan warriors and Mayan martial arts.
Yeah, that is correct. Like, during the course of the development, I have been looking into, like, their actual, like, warfare and stuff. That's actually how I was able to get the ideas for the weapons and stuff. Right now, the closest... you remember that movie Apocalypto?
Yes.
Oh, I love that movie. One of my favorites.
That's one of our references, too. That was actually a big influence on the game. Just, like, the brutality of the mm-hmm. weapons. We wanted to add, like, a comedic feel to it. Mm-hmm. I'm actually in contact with... His name is Troy. He works with a guy named Dr. Hansen. Dr. Hansen, they've been working on the... Have you heard of El Mirador?
No, I haven't.
No. Okay, I'm going to tie this all in together right now. So I've talked to this guy named Troy a few times, and he works with this guy named Dr. Hansen. Well, this so happens that Dr. Hansen, he was a consultant on Apocalypto.
Oh,
so
okay.
that is like how you're saying bring... Yeah! So, yeah, I was talking to him about this ancient Mayan city, El Mirador, and stuff. So, that is, like, it would be cool, you know, to actually get him on Skype, you know, and talk more about the warfare of the Mayans. So, that is something that we will be doing in the future.
That's something. Amazing. That's
so,
amazing.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was actually funny. Like, it was actually, because on Instagram, I just remember, I was going through Instagram, and then he posted a picture from El Mirador, and I was like, oh, I know that city. Because El Mirador is a giant ancient Mayan city. Like, this thing is massive, actually. Uh-huh. One of our levels is actually named after it. Okay. It's in the ruins. Mm-hmm. And I had, like, I asked him, I was like, dude, I was telling him, like, this is really cool stuff. So then he had sent me an article. Troy, he had sent me an article on El Mirador. And I was like, oh, yeah, I read this article a while ago back in school. So then we were talking about how they're trying to protect the city and stuff from scavengers and stuff, like having to fly out there in a helicopter, having to have armed guards. Because people, they try to loot the city. So they have people, armed guards, like assault rifles, basically protecting the area and stuff. Yeah. And he was just telling me about how Dr. Hansen is like, you know, the modern day Indiana Jones. And then he was like, oh, by the way, he was a consultant on Apocalypto. And I was like, dude, we use that movie as reference as well. This is perfect. So we're going in the right direction, because Apocalypto is one of
our influences. Learn all you can, man.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Now, one question I just thought of as you were talking about that trail and with like level design and stuff like that, since you're taking place on a strategic layer going around the map, are the actual levels themselves going to be pre-built, randomly generated, or some combination of the two?
Pre-built. Right now, they're just pre-built.
Mm-hmm.
But I do see how randomly generated could help out. But as of right now, we're just going with the pre-built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is another like really interesting part. We see a lot of games try to do randomized or procedurally generated level design. When it works, it can add so much to a game. But when it doesn't work, you can sometimes really take things down compared to a highly crafted pre-built design.
Exactly. That's why I was like, yeah, it's best to go with something like handcrafted for right now.
Mm-hmm. Now,
once we get a better feel of like how the environments are laid out, because this is also a learning process of taking Mayan cities and gamifying them, you know, so you can actually have battles on them. Once we get a better feel for it, then along the line, we might be like, oh, you know what? Let's have a few levels randomly generated. But for right now, those handcrafted.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to the combination of the strategic layer with the combat, with the other enemies or the other tribes in the game, do they grow like the same way as the player does with researching and unlocking new abilities? Or do they sort of come like pre-built with all the skills they're only going to have for that playthrough?
As of right now, that's something that we're still debating on. The strategy layer, we have it written out, but we haven't really like built it. Yeah. If that makes any sense. It's not concrete. Right now it's just written out, and we're gonna start trying to do paper prototypes. You know when people talk about, oh yeah, we did a paper prototype of it. Like we're gonna start doing that before we actually start building it, you know.
Yeah.
To test that out. But that's still debatable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's another tricky thing. Whenever you have these kinds of meta layer or the strategic layer mixing with more of a real-time or player skill design, you always run that risk of one side affecting things too much. And we see this with a lot of games that go for like mixed genres or mixed designs, where it doesn't matter how well the player is at combat, if, let's say, you just give the AI, he has plus 5 armor, so all your shots just bounce off of him. On the other hand, if they don't grow, and, you know, the player gets one upgrade that completely dominates everything, then you run the risk of trivializing the combat due to a one upgrade on the meta layer. We see these kinds of, like, push and pulls with, like, a game like, I would say, like, the XCOM redesigns as an example of that, with trying to balance, you know, the meta layer versus the tactical layer. Or in Bullock's case, it would be the combat layer.
Yeah, XCOM is also another influence. It was another influence on me wanting to build this kind of game. Because when I remember reading about, I never played the original XCOMs, but I was reading Game Informer about when they came out with Enemy Unknown, like as they were preparing to launch it and stuff. I was like, this is really cool. You got a strategy layer, and then that affects your soldiers out on the battlefield. Yeah. I was like, that's really cool. So that's something that is something that will come up later on in the future when we start working more on the strategy layer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that it's that kind of metagame or that progression between the two layers that I think really has helped the XCOM series stand that test of time. And it is one thing that, when it works, it really does elevate game designs and mechanics. But again, it's one of those things you really need to test it out, you need to plan it out before you actually decide to fully integrate into your game design.
Comes with the paper prototyping.
Definitely.
That's why, I was talking to Sam about this. Like, yeah, dude, we gotta start doing paper prototypes very soon for the strategy layer.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you just need to see how these mechanics actually play out rather than just, you know, dreaming about them in your head. And that is another key point that really separates, like, the enthusiast level from the designer point. When you can start taking these ideas and trying to ground them in reality. We are no longer saying, oh, it'll be nice if the game is procedurally generated with random skills and it's completely unique each time. And you start thinking, okay, how is this actually going to work when someone sits down and plays it?
Yeah, it is crazy when things go from an idea in your head and then as you approach the actually building out the mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, especially like right now, we're working with the combat and I'm like, oh yeah, this looks cool in my head. And then we start trying to get it to work in the game. We're like, oh, okay, there's some things we need to figure out. So, like I said, it's a cool feeling and crazy feeling when things start going from your head to, like, actually appearing on the screen. Yeah. And you actually got to, like, make it work. Definitely. Versus it just being cool in your head.
Definitely.
At the end of the day, if it doesn't work on screen, it's all bad.
Great example there, Trayvon. And again, it's one of the things that we see a lot of first-time developers struggle with when they just say, let's just put every one of our ideas into a game. It'll be the best damn game ever. And then you start integrating, and then you realize, oh, wait, this doesn't work. How are we going to fix this? And combat...
That actually goes back to...
Yep.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was actually saying, that actually goes back to, like, knowing what to add versus knowing what not to reinvent.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said before, like, okay, so yeah, we look at Arkham City, we see what works with Arkham City and Shadow Mordor for combat. We're like, okay, works, like, we see what works there, so we know, okay, what can work once we, like, what will work in Bullock and stuff. So that kind of helps having, like, a point of reference, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, the thing that we're adding to it is the whole mind element.
Yeah, and the strategic layer on top of that. And how it infers on combat.
So it all goes back to what you're referencing.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Now, two other questions that came to mind regarding the combat layer. One is, like, I'm trying to think how to best explain this. One second. Okay. One part of the combat layer that I just want to ask you about, Trayvon, is how does combat, or what you do during a combat section, affect the metagame? And I'll give you an example of that. In XCOM, depending upon how you play during the tactical layer, you'll get, you know, different resources. If someone dies, they're gone for good. Now, obviously, you're not doing the Iron Man side, but depending upon how someone plays or fights, like, what does that actually impact once you get back to the strategic layer?
Mainly resources, you conquer a city or a town that has the specific resource that you need, you have access to that resource now. And you can use that in a strategic layer to build the items that you need that require that resource. Because you had conquered the city, you now have their resource, that resource that's necessary to build the item.
All right.
Does that kind of help?
Yeah. I guess to expand on that, like, let's say someone plays the combat and they do, like, amazing. They get through it, they complete, they do everything they can.
Okay.
Like, does that, like, give you, like, bonus resources? Does
like the reward system. What's your reward system?
Yeah! That's something we're still trying to, like, figure out. Like, as of right now, the rewards is basically the resources that goes back into the strategy layer.
Yeah.
That is something, like, yeah, that we've been thinking about. Like, In the village raids, for instance, right? In the village raids, you got to burn down buildings. Like, you got to do as much damage as possible before time runs out. The enemy's going to try to kill you. Your goal in the village raid is not to conquer them. It's not to kill everyone. It's to get as many resources as possible. The more items you destroy, the more resources you get.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So, essentially, okay, if you do well in combat, that means you're able to kill more people who are trying to attack you. Therefore, you have more time to focus on obtaining, destroying buildings to get resources. Like, that's one of the fun things we talk about when it comes to how the combat layer affects the strategy layer. Like, oh, yeah, we should have this affect this. So, most of that comes up during, like, the build raids. Like, when you're talking about, oh, yeah, how does doing well in combat, how does doing well in the combat layer affect the strategy layer, this kind of conversation usually come up when we talk about our village raid levels, and it would be cool to have that work with our other different types of levels.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Now, the other part of combat that we've sort of been talking about is like sort of the timing and the fine-tuning of how someone plays a game. Are there any like interesting challenges or design considerations that you ran into, Trayvon, like with trying to get like the feel of the combat down for Bullock?
Right. Like, right now, we're in the process of transitioning from using placeholders to using our actual assets and stuff. So, we have yet to actually fully test out our combat. Like, we're still implementing assets, like animations. Like, the code is kind of there, but we're implementing our animations, our custom assets. So, we try to test it out as we go. And so far, things seem to be working, but they're not fully, not everything is fully there where we can be like, oh, yeah, this is fun. Like, right now, it's like, okay, this is kind of functional, but the entire system isn't there yet.
Yeah, and that's always one of the most challenging parts when it comes to fine-tuning or finishing a game, is getting to that level of refinement when it feels like everything has come together and everything clicks. It again goes back to when I talked with Ernest Adams about it. Like, the last 20% of your game, when you're getting to that point...
His books are cool, by the way.
I'm sorry?
His books are cool, by the way. I read one of his books. I think it was on game design. Ernest Adams' books are cool, by the way. I forgot which book I read, but it was like this giant book. It was back in college. I think it was on game design.
Yeah, I think I may have read that same book too back in college too. Like, massive thing all about game design, mechanics, and philosophy. I cannot remember the title though off the top of my head. But getting back to my thought, so it's that level of refinement again when the game starts harmonizing with all the mechanics. That's the point where you start to think, okay, now we have something. It's no longer a prototype. It's no longer just a crazy bunch of ideas. We now have something that could be considered a full-on video game.
Right, right. Yeah, like I said, we're just in that process. We're in that process of actually adding stuff. Like, we're just building right now. We haven't been able to fully test out. Like, we'll add in, okay, like, for instance, we have a spell, like, the whole converting your health into blood, converting the blood into health. Like, we have that down, but we're not at that stage yet where we're able to mix mechanics, if that makes any sense. You know, like, in games where, like, you mix mechanics together. Right now, the mechanics, they work separately, but we have yet to use them with... We're not at that level yet where we're mix-matching mechanics,
because
we're still adding in our custom assets.
Yep, definitely.
If that makes any sense.
Definitely. You don't want to add in, you don't want to be working at the strategic layer while building the combat layer out at the same time. You want to try to get them both to be perfect. And then once you have those foundations down, you can then expand on them. Once you have something steady, you can then basically make that progress. Yeah, so far, this has definitely been a great cast. It really does sound like you have a lot of the basics and a lot of the elements already formulated for the game, Trayvon. And I guess to begin to wrap up the entire podcast, we'll talk more about, I guess, the scope of the game and sort of like what the future holds or what you're planning on doing with it.
Cool,
so,
cool.
My first question then, I guess to start to wrap things up, or actually before we do that, are there any other elements of Bullock in terms of either its design, philosophy, or how you create it that you would like to bring up now that we may not have touched on over like the last hour?
I think we briefly talked on, like, yeah, magic. One of the other reasons why I decided to choose the Mayan culture, because they sacrifice, like, the cultures in Mesoamerica, right? That's, like, the ancient Mexico and stuff, right? Guatemala. They would sacrifice people to their gods, right? Like, they would, you know, using the apocalypse, though, when they're ripping out hearts and stuff, sacrificing them to their gods. And I was like, that's cool. It would be cool to gamify that. So, yeah, the reason why they're sacrificing all these people because it fuels their magic. Like, they're using blood as, like, a fuel source for their magic. So, instead of mana, it's blood. So, it makes sense then if you can use magic and you're, like, the ruler of a city, you want your magic to be strong as possible. You want it to be the strongest out there, stronger than the other lords of the other cities. So, of course, you're going to go to war. You're going to capture people. And that's what they did. They went to war to get captives to sacrifice to their gods. That's part of them going to war. So you remember how earlier we were talking about how, like, the combat affects strategy, how strategy affects the combat. That's kind of how it was with them. They go to war, capture people, come back to the cities, and sacrifice them. So I was like, that would be cool to gamify that. You're going out there, you're going to war, and as you're capturing these people and stuff, your magic gets boosted. That's something else that wasn't really mentioned during the interview. That's something that we want to present during the game.
Cool. Now, in terms of gamifying that, like, do you basically choose that at the strategic layer, the people to sacrifice, and then that will infer on the combat layer?
Yes, as a matter of fact. So, like, for instance, so if you're, like, in the village raid, right, the village raid is when you're mainly getting your captives and stuff, right? It's all about resources. Like, in the sieges and stuff, in the army clashes, it's about decimating your enemy, taking their city. But the village raid, so you're trying to get resources, so you capture people, right? You take them back to your city. Let's say you sacrifice them. You sacrifice them, it gives you a benefit in the next battle. Maybe your warriors have more, they have better armor, or their magic is boosted for a certain amount of time. So sacrificing people will have its benefits. It's kind of like pre-battle buffers or something.
All right. And I guess, does the enemies that you're going to fight, will they be able to use spells against you as well?
Yeah, over a period of time, it's kind of like, and it's according to the story too, there's sort of like a narrative. You know, like in XCOM, there was like sort of a narrative that would play out. Like when you reach a certain point, a cutscene will appear. So yeah, over time, enemies will start using, like, you'll start encountering stronger enemy, like, cities. They've already gone about conquering other people. Like in strategy games, where, like, at first you're fighting cities that only have, like, you're fighting civilizations that only have, like, one city or so. But over the course of the game, you find that there's, like, a few of them. They've conquered other people, too. When you get to that point, then yes, you will encounter enemies with magic.
Okay, cool. All right. I'm trying to think if there's any other game design or gameplay-related questions before we move on. James, do you have any questions on your end?
You talked a lot about the Mayan and the civilization and the mechanics, like, and you mentioned about the sacrifice, but you never really said who they're sacrificing to. How are you going to introduce, like, the deities aspects into your gameplay?
We've been talking about, so we named the game, so the game is called Bullock, right? We named it actually after the god of war, Bullock Chabtan. He was the god of war and sacrifice, so it kind of makes sense that you're going to war and you're sacrificing people. So we're debating on having him be the power source. We're like, by the more you're sacrificing people to him, and that fuels your magic. That increases the prowess in battle because he is the god of war and sacrifice.
Okay.
All right. I think with that, we'll move into the final part for the cast for today. And that's sort of talking more about the future, what you have in mind for Bullock in the coming months. So I guess my first question, for the people listening to the cast, what platforms are you planning on releasing the game on?
So it's for surely going to be on Steam, like on PC. Mm-hmm. And then we're trying to get it on, we want to get it on the Xbox One and the PS4. We know it's a process and it's something we're going to have to look more into. But that would be cool. So that's something we want to do, is to get them on consoles as well. And if there's enough people, we'll make a build for the Mac.
Okay. Now, at this moment in time, Have you gone through like the green light process on Steam yet, or is it still too soon to tell with that?
It's too soon, and like I said before, there's so many games on Steam Greenlight that should not be on Greenlight. We're gonna wait. Like, we're not going on Greenlight yet. Like, we're not gonna touch. We're not gonna touch Steam for a while. We're gonna hold off on that. Right. In regards to, we kind of have like a timeline of how we're gonna go about doing things. If anything, we'll approach Steam Greenlight if like between December of this year and maybe around April or May of next year. We have no intentions of going to Greenlight for a while.
All right. Now, your studio, Ninja 5, do you have a publisher for Bullock, or is this all self-funded at the moment?
This is all self-funded at the moment. So this is the plan. We will be going to Kickstarter next February, like February 2017. Yeah, the reason why we're not going now is because when it's too early and too, you got to build a fan. Before you try to release a game, before you try to do crowdfunding, you got to build the fan base ahead of time. And for some reason, like, that, I thought it would be obvious to people, but, like, a lot of people, they don't really realize that. They think you just drop something on the internet, and it's just going to get hot real quick.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, hell, with GameWisdom itself, it's the whole reason why I've been doing more with social media, learning YouTube, stuff like that. You need to build that core up, and you need to get your presence known. And even doubly so when you go to crowdfunding, you can't just show up on Kickstarter and say, I have a game idea, give me $500,000. It's not going to work, especially today. The classic example that I turned to for a developer who did it right would be Red Hook Games with The Darkest Dungeon. They spent a lot of time building a fan base, putting teasers out, you know, feeling the market, and then they spent on top of that 6 months of putting together the Kickstarter, you know, what they wanted, what are the goals, how are they going to approach it, and it worked for them. I mean, I've spoken to the guys several times, and it's definitely an example of a game that pretty much succeeded every step of the way from prototype to Kickstarter to early access to release.
Yeah, that's the common trend with all these. Like, I've talked to a few people with successful Kickstarters, and it's like, one of them is, dude, you got to build your fan base way ahead of time. Mm-hmm. At least 6 months. I say a year. Like, you got to build it. Like, you can't just drop something on the internet. Mm-hmm. Like, the other thing we're planning on doing is, so we're going to have our pre-alpha build. We're going to have, like, a build ready in about July. Mm-hmm. But in August, though, we're going to do a world announcement. We're going to create our announcement trailer. We're going to do our press release. We're going to contact all the press outlets and stuff in August. So you kind of see how that works, where it's like, okay, we do that in August. The Kickstarter is until February. So that gives us more time to pick up more people. And then about 2 months before the actual Kickstarter, we're going to release another trailer and contact the press again.
Yeah, and
so that's why I think when I first contacted you on Twitter, I was saying, like, yeah, man, we're not doing an official like press announcement until like August. But right now, though, we're just trying to build up get a little bit of coverage, just a little bit.
Yeah. And test the waters, too, to see how the market responds to your ideas. And again, when you're doing it this kind of staggered release or staggered announcements, it gives you time to make any adjustments or see that reaction. If someone, let's say you get a response from saying, it looks cool, but can you talk more about so-and-so? Then you have an idea, okay, when we do the Kickstarter, let's expand on that. And the more you can get the feel from the market, the more it's going to give you that chance to succeed. Because again, as you just said, Trayvon, if you just show up day one on Kickstarter with an idea that you've never shown to anyone, how are you going to know what to improve or what people are actually interested in? You're not.
Dude, this goes back to our original conversation of the internet. It's cool because it gives everybody an opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. But the problem is, and I've talked to a few people about this, the internet and social media, it's created like a defensive mentality in people's minds. They think, oh yeah, I just create the websites, the social media, right? Mm-hmm. I just post. People are going to come to me. They forgot about the basics, though. You still got to do the basics. You got to go out there and contact people.
Yes.
You got to be on the offensive, too. So, Yeah,
and that's a really good point. It's one of the things that I've learned, and I'm still learning with Game Wisdom. I mean, when, I guess, James, you can speak to this. When you first contacted me, I was still very off of social media. I wasn't really on the offensive there.
Uh-huh.
And now things have definitely been, I guess the tide has slowly been turning, with reaching out to more people, improving the YouTube channel, just trying to make my presence known.
I mean, this very interview is kind of a hallmark to that, mm-hmm. in the fact that, you know, you met, we met Trayvon on, what was it, Twitter?
Twitter.
On Twitter, yeah.
Yeah. And again, if I didn't do that, I would never have met Trayvon, and I would never be building up my fan base and building it up on Twitter and YouTube and social media. And it's the same relation with game development, especially with indie developers today. As you just said, Trayvon, with this plan for staggering out the press release and building up the community, you're getting that fan base going before you're going to commit to a Kickstarter. And that's going to give you a much greater chance at succeeding. And, of course, it also gives you the chance of getting even more people, because let's say your fans really like your idea. They're going to tell their friends, and et cetera, et cetera. But you wouldn't have been able to do that if you just decided to show up one day.
Exactly. They're like, who are you? There's no track record. There's no trail of, like content and stuff. Yeah. But, yeah, like, they just have this defensive mentality. Even then, like, the social media is not enough. You have to, like, how I said, I was like, yo, is there anyone out there who writes about games or do podcasts? So I was like, I need to, like, contact some people right now.
Yeah.
Like, versus just posting stuff online. Like, it's cool just to post stuff, but you got to, like, go on the offensive and stuff.
Definitely.
That's why the internet's cool. The internet, like, yeah, it unlocked the floodgates for a lot of stuff, but it gave an opportunity to people who really know what they're doing and stuff to really shine.
Yeah.
And like, and that's why I like what you're doing. You're like, you're creating content for people. You're going out there, you're interviewing people. Like, what you're doing is really cool. That's why I have mad respect for people who do podcasts, who write about games and stuff. Because I see what they're trying to do. And it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for the kind words. And it's one of the things, again, that I love about doing these podcasts and doing Game Wisdom is reaching out to these people. I mean, we talked about this on a previous cast, but before I started doing Game Wisdom, I could never see myself doing this. I was 10 for 10 on the introverted scale. I couldn't be reaching out, socializing, and now, you know, contrast that to today where I'm on Twitter making posts, reaching out, and having these conversations like they're becoming second nature to me.
Yeah, you can't be afraid to talk to people. It's kind of like this. Some people, they might get mad at me for this analogy, but it's kind of like you see like musicians, rappers on the streets. They're trying to sell their mixtapes and stuff. Like you have to be out there.
Yeah,
you can't just sit in your like. You can't just sit at the studio all day just working on stuff in a vacuum. You have to be out there interacting with people.
Yeah, definitely. And one really good point that I want to clarify on and bring up for people listening that you also made, Trayvon, is the fact that you're going to approach Kickstarter with an early alpha build, with something concrete. And this goes back to what you talked about at the beginning of the cast, with how you showed like a basic concept and basic footage to people to motivate them and convince them to come on board with you. And that is such a huge, important step for when you go to crowdfunding. And again, it's one of the things that we see a lot of people mess up on. You can't go on to crowdfunding these days with nothing to show. You can't say, I have an idea, here's a drawing of it, give me $100,000.
Yeah.
It's not going to work. You need to show people that, hey, this is someone who, A, knows what they're doing, B, they have something already available, and C, they have a plan. And it's those three key parts that are just so important to convince people to basically support you with their money.
Exactly. Unless you're like, I've seen some people, they're like industry veterans and they're like well known. They can go on there. Who's that guy? Was it Double Fine? Like, it was like years ago when I first heard about Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Dude, he came on the Kickstarter. Yeah, like, yeah, when you're people like that, then yeah, you can like show concept art and raise like $500,000. But yeah, for the average person like me and you, we gotta build something. Like, we have to have a track record.
Yeah. Mighty Number 9.
Yeah, Mighty Number 9 has definitely been hit. And there was, of course, recently, John Romero, who's, of course, known as one of the original guys behind Doom, he went on a Kickstarter without any demo, any, like, early access build, and he decided after, like, I think a day to cancel the whole thing because he felt like it wasn't a strong enough Kickstarter. Mm.
Yeah, that's a smart move, you know. Like it all depends on like how well known you are and stuff. But yeah, for the average person like you and me, we gotta have something to show to people. Like,
definitely.
You think I'm the first? But I'm probably not the first person with an idea of combining. No, actually, this is not the first idea to combine a strategy in hack and slash. Like, there's so many people out there who've probably done, they've done the same thing. And everybody has an idea. And if you can't have something to show for it, if you can't, it's all about executing it at the end of the day.
Yep, definitely. All right, getting back to the actual, your plan. So you're playing on this staggered press release. You're hoping to do the Kickstarter in February of next year. Have you,
yes.
Have you started, I guess, formulating what that Kickstarter would be, or is it still too soon to tell with, like, the state of Bullock right now?
So when it comes to the Kickstarter, all we know is this so far is, okay, so we're working on, how should I say this? So for the Kickstarter, so the build we're working on for the game is that it's the prologue to the game. The prologue it shows you what leads up to the events that start off in the game.
Okay.
So the prologue is something that we're working on right now, and the build will be ready in July. So when the Kickstarter comes around, like, people who back the game, like, yeah, we're gonna use footage from the but then people who back the game, they're gonna get access to this pre-alpha build.
Cool.
In regards to funding goals, I'm still jumping around on different ideas. I've talked to a few people who've run successful Kickstarter ideas, but it's mainly on how to build a fan base and stuff. That's the main thing. Yeah. Like, I'm like, okay, I know the game's gonna be cool, but if there's no fan base, then it's not gonna work. So have you heard of Jotun?
I think so.
Yeah, North mythology and stuff. I've contacted them on how they ran a Kickstarter. I contacted the people behind Project Resurgence. Have you heard of Battalion 1944?
Sounds familiar, but yeah, go for it.
It's the World War II shooter that's coming out.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've contacted them. I'm trying to think, who else I contacted? There's a game called Wanderer, because... I was like, yo, I see you guys did successful with your Kickstarter, man. Like, how did you guys go about doing this? How did you go about building your fan base and stuff? So they told me what they did, what didn't work. They told me where to go to and stuff. So that's kind of how I picked up on, okay, I need to contact the press, build the fan base ahead of time. There's all kinds of steps needed, definitely. You know, instead of me just shooting in the dark.
Definitely. And I would love to follow up with you in a few months when you start planning the Kickstarter. I would love to have you back on and talk about that, because I think that's a very informative part, especially for students and enthusiasts listening who want to go to crowdfunding. Because a Kickstarter playing is such a new concept for a lot of people that there's always more room to learn, especially when you learn from someone who's doing it or has already done it.
Right, I would love to be back on the show, especially when, like, in the next upcoming months, we're going to have more to show for Bullock and stuff. Like, I know when you were asking me questions about the game, I was kind of like, well, it's kind of like this, and this. But it would be really cool, though, next time I'm on the show to actually show you guys builds. So then you're like, oh, this is awesome. This is how it plays out. It's not just ideas. It's not just half mechanics and stuff. So, yeah, I would love to come back on the show. Like, I love what you guys are doing.
Yep, thank you. And... definitely, I would say one of the things I'm really liking what I'm hearing from you, Traylon, is the fact that you've definitely done a lot of your homework, not just with the mechanics and the design, but with the forming of the studio, your plans for Kickstarter, your plans for the coming months. These are a lot of things, again, that we see even people who are in the industry who move to an independent studio mess up on just as much as someone, you know, straight out of college and enthusiast trying to break in. And it really... sounds like you guys, and you especially, have done your homework. And I really do hope that this will all work out for you, because you're really stacking the deck in your favor with the research and the due diligence that you're putting in.
Thank you. Yeah, I hope it works out too. It'd be a shame if it didn't work out. It's kind of like, ha, you did all this preparation. But for it to work, though, like, if this does work, then we know there's a formula. Like, that's the thing, is finding the formula. Well, there's no magic formula.
Yeah,
but when you have, like, a blueprint... like, if this works, then we know that there's a blueprint then.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, and that's one of the things I've been trying to expand on with GameWisdom, because, again, there aren't, as you just said, Traylon, there's no guide to making a video game. Everyone's story is completely different. And on one hand, that's great, but on the other hand, for someone, you know, fresh out of college or looking at this in high school, they have no idea what actually goes into making a video game. But if we can establish at least a basic set of goals or basic set of things to do, that is at least a good step in the right direction.
Yeah, especially seeing, like you said, there's like a lot of, like, I joined a few Facebook groups, like, for game developers, and there's like a lot of people there. They're like in school, they're in high school still, and they're like talking about making a video game, and like they're beginning development on the game. And I'm like, Dude, if I knew about this stuff in high school, you know how different my life would be? Yeah. So that is cool to have. Like, that would be cool.
It's kind of funny hearing you say that, because, like, how old are you, Trayvon?
Dude, I'll be 23 in August.
it's just cool hearing somebody that's 23 talking to some older dudes saying, man, if I had that in high school.
Yeah, like, I get to be old. Like, I remember in high school in the 90s, I would have killed for a video game programming course.
Yeah, that's why the internet is, like, awesome.
Yeah.
I didn't have access to stuff until, like, my senior year of high school. I'm like, dude, it's senior year. If I would have known this stuff when I was a freshman or in middle school, like, this guy named, his name is Jose, right? He was, like, actually one of the guys who taught me how to do 3D modeling and stuff. He was like, yeah, he used to do mods and stuff back in middle school and stuff. And I'm like, this was back when I was in college. I'm like, what? I wish I would have known about this stuff in middle school. In middle school, I was playing Yu-Gi-Oh!
Yes. Oh, my God. I was just talking with Mayor Shepherd from Men at Software a week ago, and she was like talking about, oh yeah, my college, we had this great game design program. I'm like, really? You had game design program? My college was phasing it out. And then the year later, after I graduated, they said, oh, you know what? We're going to do a game design program now.
Actually, I'm just like, a part of that interview. It was actually a cool interview.
Yeah, thanks.
I don't remember how far into it I got, but she was actually, talking about, I think it was one of the people she's working with right now. She had met them in college or something. So I was like, oh, this is really cool.
Yeah, and again, it's always great to hear these different stories and talk to people trying to do this. It's one of the things that I think has really grown and I love to do with Game Wisdom. All right. I'm trying to think if there's any other final questions I have for you, Trayvon. I guess while I'm thinking about this, James, do you have any wrap-up questions on your end you want to ask?
No. I think it was a great cast.
Thank you.
I think that really just about does it. Again, since Bullock is still quite a ways out, we can't talk too much more about the specifics, but you definitely sound like you have that plan of attack going forward. And as I said, it would definitely be great to get back in touch with you, and we can talk more about the Kickstarter and more of that crowdfunding side when the time comes.
Yeah, I would love to.
All right. Yeah, this has definitely been a fantastic cast. And again, Trayvon, it has been a pleasure talking with you and meeting with you. Again, this all started from a Twitter conversation. So I definitely wish you and the rest of your team the best of luck. And yeah, definitely don't be a stranger. And hopefully we can talk again in a few months and see just where things have gone from now to the pre-Kickstarter stage.
Most definitely. It was good talking to you and James. Like, thank you so much, Josh.
Yep, not a problem. And as I said, definitely, especially for those of you listening, I'm always looking for new guests for these casts. I think we've always had these great conversations. So if you're a student, developer, enthusiast, as long as you're interested in talking about game design industry, I definitely want to hear from you. So with all that said, we're going to wrap things up for tonight's cast. James, it was a pleasure hanging out with you today. And I think this was one of, like, your first few developer interview casts. So how did you like it on your end?
It was great. And it's, as a personal note, it's really good to see young developers just passionate and on fire for the gaming industry and wanting to just do stuff. Yeah. I'm gonna grab everybody I know that can do anything, and we're gonna make an awesome game. Now I love it. It's gonna be beautiful.
And again, I'd say on top of that, the fact that again that you've done the due diligence, you've learned from what other people have done, you're making a plan and following through with it instead of just, you know, throwing shit against the wall and seeing what's going to happen. You're actually managing a group. You have this plan for how you want this game to go, how you want to handle the press, how you want to do Kickstarter. And again, these are things that it sounds like it should be second nature to a lot of people, but there are so many developers, either veterans coming into indie or people going from enthusiasts to trying to develop a game, that mess up on these finer points. And it's great to see you really just embracing it and really going forward with it. And as I said, I really do wish you the best of luck with Bullock.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Like I said, thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, not a problem. So We're going to end things here for this week's episode of the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. I already mentioned about podcast guests, but we are also looking for guest pieces for the site. You can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. To check out my video content, including live streams and video plays, let's plays, review, supplemental, stuff like that, you can find me on Twitch under GW Bicer. And you can check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. There are links on the front page to both. If you'd like to support Game Wisdom's ongoing Patreon campaign to secure monthly funding and bring back the fan favorite feature of developer roundtable casts, you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom or by clicking the banner on the front page. Any donations will be greatly appreciated there. So, again, thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. And be sure to tune in next week for more great content. Anyway, have a great rest of the week, and we will see you all next time. Take care.